This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, Jan, and with me as always are Nick, Becca, and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
Howdy.
We have a great show for you this week. We're actually here with most of the players in the GM for Pelgrane's official 13th Age stream that streams on the Pelgrane Twitch channel. We're here with the GM, Cody. You may remember him from our second Foundry episode. Cody, welcome back to the show.
Hey, my name is Cody Shendrowski. Happy to be back once again. I now work for Foundry. I don't recall if I did it the last time we talked, but I helped develop the core software now. I helped make the 13th Age unofficial system for Foundry, along with a couple other developers. And somewhere along the way, the game I was already, I pitched it to Pelgrane, and they're like, yeah, sure, we'd love to have a stream. So we've been now streaming for them as the official 13th Age stream for the last year and a half, somewhere in there.
Awesome.
Time has gone by. And I think we just crossed episode 100 even.
Awesome. Well, can you, why don't you introduce the cast of the show, and then cast, just feel free to jump in, introduce yourself, let us know how you got into gaming, that sort of thing.
We open up every stream this way, so let's do it like normal. Ellen, who are you and who do you play?
I'm Ellen, and I play Dame Kiri Jadespine. I got into gaming, I've been playing since high school, and I know Cody in real life, so he invited me to join this little 13th Age campaign he was getting started, which was originally going to look very different than how it's ended up. And here we are, several years later.
Ellen plays a dwarven operatic bard.
Awesome.
Seb?
I am Seb. I play Raza, the lizard folk barbarian, and wow. gaming has been something I've been doing for the better part of a decade or so by now. If I remember, my first module was Weeby Kobolds 2 for Pathfinder. And I distinctly remember my character dying to the fireworks explosion aboard the stranded ship, not a few encounters away from the beginning. So that was my sort of trial by fire.
And speaking of character death, Seb's character unfortunately just suffered second PC death, actually. Both of your characters have died in our campaign. Between that and work, Seb just is now taking a break from the campaign. Rumham?
Hello, I'm Rumham. I play Kalia, the Shieldbearer cleric, who is notoriously bad at being a cleric. I was actually brought into tabletop by Seb. He was my first DM. And we played tens and hundreds of hours, probably, of 5th edition
and
different Dungeon World modules as well. And I've been hooked ever since.
And of course, we have Pow.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Leanne Morins, and I'm a commander.
And also, when it comes to tabletop, I think my first real experience was with Cody here with, it was Pokemon, right? It was a Pokemon one.
Yeah, we played Pokemon the Tabletop United, which that's a clunky system.
That's a word for it. And then after that, it was Star Wars. My first experience was One Piece. The reskinned D&D One Piece one.
That was a good one.
And then 13th Age has been the first, like, real official system I've ever really played, and no one knows here, but I used my soundboard for that introduction.
I thought you might have. Not pictured here, we have a final player, Max. He plays Lucian, the ranger barbarian, now just ranger, who is a werewolf who found peace through piety. This is his first campaign ever, and I think for a lot of the group here is kind of new to gaming, all things considered.
Well, so you said that you pitched your stream or your game to Pelgrane. how did you get into 13th Age as a group? And then how did you, like, was, did you start streaming at another point, or did you just basically start a brand new campaign when you pitched it to Pelgrim?
So Bundle Holding is a popular site. They mm-hmm. send out like, oh, for, you know, $8, you get all of the core book and expansions for this thing. 13th Age popped up. I don't even know why I was looking at the emails. Normally I don't. I'm like, oh, this system sounds cool. Picked it up. I'm like, yeah, I'll give this a try. We played for probably, our campaign's been going on for like 3 years now. So we played for like a year, year and a half. And then Gen Con came up virtually because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'll run a bunch of one-shot games. Hey, Pelgrim, do you want us to stream this? They're like, sure. And I'm like, all right, it was really cool to stream with a bunch of people. Hey, Pelgrim, can I keep streaming and just do like the campaign I've been playing with my friends? And they're like, sure. And I'm like, hey, guys, you want to do what we've been doing every Monday, but now also like have people able to watch it? And they're like, sure. And there was a little bit of shift as we had to, you know, be a little more careful about our language, but like, I'll think like nothing else really changed.
We are quite familiar with that.
At the very start of the stream, I had to give the party an item that zapped them anytime they swore. So it doesn't matter.
Was that item like maybe like vase shaped or jar shaped? So that
it was a purity ring.
Yeah.
I have been zapped many a times by
I'm
that
pretty
ring.
Sure you're the only one who. I'm pretty sure
no,
you're the
I
only one
know.
Who has.
Lucian got it once.
Yeah. No, I had to argue that one time that he needed to get zapped, because usually I'm the one that gets zapped, and I feel, you know, a little attacked by the purity ring.
It makes fools of us all.
So, I mean, as you guys have been talking and describing your characters and, you know, who you're playing in this campaign, it sounds like we've got, if I remember right, we've got a bard, a barbarian, a cleric, a commander, and a ranger. Well, I'm curious, what are each of your characters' one unique things? Because this is something that defines 13th Age and one of the unique things of this gaming system, but also ends up saying a lot about who your character is and sometimes how it plays out in the game. So what are your one unique things?
Well, if nobody's going to go, I could talk all day about Raza, right? Like, I had a dissertation on the lizard man that just wants to hit things real hard with an axe. My one unique thing for Raza was that he was the first of his egg clutch to sort of tolerate the smooth skins, as it were. And the introduction to Raza, I believe, was a fairly rough patch, right? We did a sci-fi one-shot and then sort of just transliterated the whole lizard thing into the world of the campaign. And I guess from there, tolerating the smooth skins in a fantasy world sort of opens that door for that Warhammer-esque, you know, lizard folk empire, you know, the first of the kind to send delegations, the first of the kind to send, like, you know, set up meetings and trades. And that's sort of the long vision I had for that barbarian. But
how's it working out for you?
You know, I like to think that Cody and I have had some talks behind the scenes about what Ross's fate really is. I think the last appearance in the campaign of our barbarian friend was a sort of draconic egg. And the ideas that lie therein imply that if Raza were to be returned, he would be like bigger and badder than ever, and probably in a better position than before to sort of start that scaled empire.
So I have a question. Does Raza ever think that these smooth skins taste really good?
There was a lot of discussion capacity for evil tangential behavior in the campaign, specifically with our ranger's sort of devotion to the priestess and her ideals, right? Plus, generally, like, eating your neighbors doesn't make for good cohabitation. So it's real hard to you get jobs whenever, you know, it's just as likely that you're going to eat the troublemakers as you are the person giving you the quest, you know? So I think he settles on sin makes the flesh tastier, right?
It's like a seasoning.
It's yeah, the more evil you are, the more inclined Raza is to take a good bite out of you.
You buy that.
And so that's an interesting perspective. I'm playing a bugbear in a 5e campaign, and so there's a similar sort of tension of this is a monster, you know, he's supposed to be eating all the humans, that sort of thing. So yeah, having that seasoning, if you will, I may have to try to work that in.
it lets you get away with stuff whenever you have that justification, and it doesn't have to be like sort of paladin ideals, right? So that's the fun of a non-human sort of more violent sort of race.
So I play Kalia, who originally started out as just a plain old cleric. And this was because her one unique thing was that she was the first Asimir to serve the Crusader. I was really, really intrigued by the Crusader as an icon. And going into creating her character, I was really intrigued with this idea of like justice at any cause, whether it's, you know, innocent or not, who kind of stumbled across the party and decided, yes, I will blend in with these random adventurers and go across the land to, you know, doing the Crusader's bidding, which did end up changing after being forced to pick whether or not she wanted to continue serving the Crusader or protect these weird non-Crusader followers who had kind of become her friends. And ultimately, she did end up deciding to leave the Crusader. It was a two sessions that battle was. It was like at least two sessions. There was a lot of deliberation kind of internally for myself as a player of, do I want to continue playing this character? I ultimately decided it would be interesting to kind of explore leaving the Crusader and the ramifications of that. And there were ramifications. There were assassination attempts. There were meteors thrown at our home base. Lots of really like wacky, zany stuff, which has now kind of led to, you know, Kalia, she lost her powers for a little bit, which is why she ended up picking up her shield. So that also led to some fun inner party shenanigans as she tried to, you know, grapple with, is God real or not?
I actually never, I rallied with Kalia for almost a year and a half now, but I never really knew myself. Did you ghost the Crusader?
Yes, yeah. So Seth actually joined us pretty shortly after kind of all of this had gone down. So yeah, that's why the Crusader hates Kalia's, because she ghosted him.
I don't know if ghosted is the right word. We threw him into hell.
Yeah, yeah.
I gave you my shield. Please respond.
Yeah, and she tried to throw the shield in a pit of lava, and so yeah, it has been ultimately kind of one of my favorite character concepts that I've ever kind of concocted, with much help from Cody as well, because we got to, as I was deciding what the hell I'm supposed to do with the cleric with no cleric powers, there was a lot of sifting through different classes and stuff, trying to figure out which direction I would take my character. So that was also really interesting as well.
I would like to say I'm not the mean GM saying do this. Another player drove this conflict, and I'm just like, all right. I mean, they care about the priestess, and they don't want an ally who's aligned with the Crusader. That's fair.
Yeah, it definitely was kind of like a held at gunpoint. You gotta choose my way or the highway kind of thing. And you know, it ended up, you know, we're over 100 episodes in. Obviously, something was right.
I hate to talk about Max while he's not here, but we made a lot of decisions.
Yeah.
Just thinking about him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just remember, okay, you can leave the Crusader, but the Crusader is not going to leave you.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely.
Well, it's always fun. I mean, one of the things that you're supposed to do with One Unique Things is to incorporate it into the campaign. And so it's really neat hearing how that has played out in your guys' world. And even just kind of hearing the bouncing around of the dynamics between your characters. There's a lot of memories appreciated here. I think
yeah,
that's awesome.
I didn't realize until Cody had said it that we have been playing for 3 years ish, which is like insane.
that's a really good run. That's awesome.
Yeah, there's definitely like, there's probably things that I'm forgetting because we've done so much. So it's been really fun.
I play Dame Kiri Jade Spine, and her one unique thing is that she was the first major like dwarf to really break out in opera. I can't remember exactly how we phrased it, but basically she was the first major dwarven opera star. So she started off in like full diva mode and very much all about, oh yeah, I've done a performance like this, I know this. And she still is actually really well connected. And then as the campaign has gone on, we sort of leaned into the dwarven side of it and really exploring how she's particularly worldly for dwarves. We've kind of, a lot of dwarves are very focused on their clans, and so she's particularly well traveled, and she's particularly focused on, no, we have to work with a lot of other people and stuff. So she's wrested back control of her clan, and she's trying to grow it like economically, and she's like, I don't know, there's a lot of business stuff that she ends up getting involved in accidentally. But yeah, she was always a very simple concept and just sort of played as large as possible.
Yeah, I haven't heard Swan Lake until you've heard it in the original Dwarven.
Exactly.
Yeah, unfortunately, now that we stream, Twitch will block us for most like music, even if it's not copyrighted. But yeah. Back before then, like, we often would play like random operatic music or her bardic songs and such, which was always fun.
You can't forget the best operatic song you've ever done in this matter, Bo.
Yeah. When you're
playing a basketball game and you just put on Space Jam.
Yes.
Yes.
This is a space opera, yes.
Yes. That was so good. And thanks to the Dame, we have our dungeon, or not dungeon, our base building simulator.
Yeah.
We've made Cody Photoshop us multiple maps as we expand our base and talk about the finances and how much money it costs to run a manor of that size. So that's also fun.
I have no idea where all the rest of you are spending your money, because all of the Dame's money basically goes into like propping up the Jade Spine clan and putting in like, okay, we need bigger fort, we need more forge capacity, we have these debts, okay, we need to build this building.
I will definitely speak up as somebody who has played a lot of old school RPGs, that one of my favorite sort of books for this sort of inspiration is what is it, Fighter Conqueror King, from I don't know, that Moldvay release of D&D, or
yeah, Adventure
Conqueror King, man. And I think Cody, have you ever read that book?
I have not.
See, that's the one of my favorite things about it, is that the man really does just brute force it.
I wouldn't go that far. I run off of Home Bases, which is in a single small section from Palgrave Press, and the lair items from the Escalation magazine.
Is that where we got Gertrude from?
Yes, Gertrude is a lair item from the Escalation magazine about holy items.
Gertrude is our home gargoyle alarm system. She actually was unfortunately slain in battle, but she was very, very important to me, and I insisted that whenever Cody voice her, that he use a very silly voice, because Cody loves doing voices.
Hackaday Brooklyn.
Let's not forget Pal, though. Pal, your character's out.
Yeah, Leon Morns. Her one unique thing was that she was the first legislator, which is 40 Empire, generally speaking, a judge, jury, and executioner bounty hunter hybrid, with the land rapidly expanding and criminals are running rampant, having a dedicated job specifically to taking care of them and ensuring justice is dispatched where town guards and such can't reach. That's been her entire purpose. She was actually meant to be a side character originally. Because originally I had Johnny, who was a dark elf rogue. And his one unique thing was having an entire organization after him. It was left intentionally vague. But things changed, and now Leanne's my main character, which was surprising. And yeah, she grew attached to this ragtag bag of idiots.
She saved us.
I imagine she's also able to open some doors that were previously unopened, sometimes forcibly.
Yeah.
Definitely. I will say Commander is actually one of the most effective healing classes I've ever seen, which is kind of really strong.
Yeah, honestly, Leanne does more healing for the party than Kalia does as a cleric. So, you know, Kalia's got that burst healing down, but the Commander really has a good sustain.
Leanne has gotten to the point where I have something to support everybody at this point. I roll sustains to keep the bard songs going. I have healing. Yeah. I give saves to other people if I succeed a save. I have a butter knife.
Yeah. You should see what.
Don't forget the butter knife.
I think that's awesome. Those are certainly unique things. And it's neat hearing how all of them kind of be working together and playing together into the formation of the campaign.
Yeah, one unique thing is always, like, I think a lot of their first passes were kind of generic, and I'm like, pushed a little more based on the book's guidance. I'm like, no, take a little more of a stance here, you know. But then, like, I got an entire pitch on an entire branch of, like, you know, self-serving law enforcement. I'm like, all right, see, that's cool. I'm in.
I feel like a lot of our second characters, because a lot of us have had second characters now, are like a lot more specific on the one unique things. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, so I had Patches, who was a chaos mage who was a dog, and his one unique thing was that he had previously belonged to the Lich King and had then been killed and resurrected by like the Prince of Shadows, and that was where he got his magic. And so he was, but like, that's such a weird thing, and it establishes so many weird things in the world. It's very, very different from like, oh yeah, she's an opera singer, you know. They're just very different approaches on the second characters.
Your very first character was a cabbage farmer.
That's true, Graham the cabbage farmer.
Yeah, but that the dog when you say is amazing. Like, I love that.
What was it? Biting the Lich King's ankles?
Yeah.
Lich King's lap dog.
Yeah. He bit the Lich King's ankle, and the Lich King reflexively yeeted him across the room. And the Prince of Shadows thought this was just so hilarious that he resurrected Patches. And that was just kind of a weird little journey for a dog to go on. And so Patches now has chaos magic, but he's a dog, so he can't control it.
Right. No, that's great. We've actually had a lot of conversations, and we even redid a podcast on One Unique Things, kind of because I joined a campaign and a lot of the other players had very generic One Unique Things, and it upset me a little. I got on my soapbox and preached to the masses. But I mean, so yeah, that Patches, that's a great one. I was going to ask you guys if you have like a one unique thing that has been your favorite, that you're like, this, when I'm trying to explain what one unique things are, I go to this to kind of showcase it. Do you have a favorite one unique thing or something that you reference if you're ever trying to explain it?
Well, Toon, Cody here started with a side character he had called Opie. And he was the occultist for our campaign. And his one unique thing is that he's an astral ant researcher. And those astral ants are literally the entirety of why he even has occultist powers to begin with. And I kind of fleshed out the astral ant part myself, because I ended up playing Opie at one point. But I went on a whole tirade on astral ants being gateways to the other realms. there's a lot of details on the matter that I've completely forgotten because it was all insane ramblings.
It was a fun character. I remember Ophid really well.
That was great.
I had no idea that that was a character that Cody had come up with. I thought that was all you, pal.
Yes. Yeah. If you recall, you met Ophid and Leanne at the same time.
Right, that was years ago in real time. So much has happened since then. That's why I said I'm probably forgetting things because we've been playing this for so long.
I remember that session very well, though.
Because you were GMing that, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You, Rum, and Max threw the whole operation off.
That's okay. Yeah, I was not part of the
question. As a GM, like as for one unique thing, I would say, you know, provide a hook for your GM. That's the big reason to have it. And you don't have to know for yourself what it is. You can just be something like, I don't know, Astromantar, that sounds cool. Honestly, Johnny's original, I have an organization after me. It's a lot, like it's generic, but that's a nice hook potential. What I don't like is, you know, I'm the firstborn of my family, sworn to uphold my family's name. That's boring. But if you're like, I am the first son ever born to my family, now you're on to something a little more interesting.
I actually really like the Legislatorator one because it establishes, like, it opens up this whole realm of, like, okay, I want to care about the legal systems in the world, but it's not, and it's not super overblown. It's interesting, but it doesn't, like, give Leanne too much power inherently in the world. It's just a really nice bite-sized chunk of asserting something about the world. Like, I mean, that's kind of where I've arrived at is, your one unique thing should actually assert something about the world. Like, it shouldn't just be a job title.
There was an old podcast that I listened to called The Sons of Cryos. They were talking about character pitches. This is before 13th Age came out. And I think it was from a Ron Edwards game that they got it, but they were calling it Bangs. Like, your character should have something that, if they could kick in a door and describe themselves, that it should be, like, explosive and powerful and immediately gripping. And so that's kind of been my guideline for one unique thing. So if someone comes to me with a, as Cody was saying, like, hey, I'm thinking this, I'm like, well, that's cool, but how can we like make it explosive and something that immediately adds, as you were saying, like, adds something to the world right from the get-go of the campaign?
Yeah.
So we've heard a couple of icons thrown out there, the Crusader, who was bitterly betrayed, and the Priestess. Who are your favorite icons, either in a game or just an icon that you think is really cool, even if it's not a relationship in your current campaign?
Never mind. You go, Pat.
I'm the one with 4 points in the Emperor here.
No, 3, my bad. Double check.
Leanne is inherently tied to the Emperor of the Dragon Empire, which the Empire in and of itself is, I think, an interesting icon to work with due to the sheer variety in what that could entail depending on the way you want to even run a campaign. On a personal note, outside of character relations, I am partial to the Prince of Shadows. Just because he opens up a lot of really weird options as well. Just due to the nature of what he can steal and the mystery behind him.
Yeah, I like. So I've got to ask you a question. Do you view the Emperor as a positive icon or a negative icon? We did our interview with Rob. He was like, most people, even though they write the Emperor one way, most people look at that image of the Emperor in the 13-page rulebook of, you know, the guy on the throne with the goblet of wine. And as Rob said, they look at him like, man, what an asshole. I hate that guy. Whether they read it or not, I'm like, well, then why did you pick that picture, Rob? I said, that's your reaction now, you know, years later. So
the Emperor, I think, you know, the Emperor himself, I see positive, but he's definitely got that smug energy. Mm-hmm. On a whole, though, like for the connections of what the Emperor would entail, though, you know, I see him more as a mixed bag. You're going to have, you know, those stalwart heroes that work under the Empire, and on the same hand, you're going to have the people who skirt closer to the more underworld side and
Yeah.
Maybe frame a few innocent people just to get their own hides out of trouble. But I would lean more towards positive for the Emperor himself.
Mm-hmm. I like the Archmage because they seem like a good gateway for Gonzo fantasy to break out into campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard something about undead planets just being part of just official adventures. Is that a thing? So
Shards of the Broken Sky, I think, adds some pretty weirdness to what can be considered part of the overworld. Yeah,
I think just an Archmage Observatory, hidden information, you know, a conspiracy, you know, to sort of hide this thing in the sky. I think that would be with the centered around the Archmage. That would be sort of my ideal focus for an iconic campaign, I think.
I mean, the Dame is very closely tied with the Dwarf King, so we've kind of explored a little bit there. But, like, the thing is, I don't find, like, the particular icons, like, any, like, as written in the book, I don't really find many of them, like, more interesting than another. It's when you actually put them into a campaign and you start building additional lore about them. So, like, the concept of the Dwarf King by himself, I'm like, okay, sure. But then when we started putting in, okay, there's all of these clans, and what does the clan politics look like? Then it's like, oh, this is really interesting, and I really enjoy this. And I liked the lore. Well, I mean, part of it is like, written and official, but, like, the lore around the Lich King I find really interesting, along with Prince of Shadows and stuff like that. But it's really the stuff that we've done in our campaign to flesh out, I guess, not just the icons themselves, but also, like, the people that they're in control over that I think really make them shine.
And I think that's a good point, because, you know, they are written in a way, but they don't become real until they're played. And so the, you know, how you interact with them in your individual campaigns, it does shift the what they're like. That's a good point.
Like, reading them, or reading the sort of text surrounding the icons in the core book, the authors made a point to sort of ground them. They're not, there are sort of implications of divinity, but none of them sort of stand out as gods in and of themselves. And so that mutability, I think, really helps. In there comes a point where you have to, like, either decide, am I going to use a system for the setting, or am I going to use it for the rules? And in some systems, it's impossible to separate the setting from the rules. And that mutability really works in 13th Age. The best icon is the icon in your heart.
My personal favorites were the Crusader and the Lich King. Those were kind of the most unique to me. Of course, you know, you've got the druids and the elves and the dwarves and the good priest, you know, priestess. That was all very familiar concepts, and I wanted to explore things that were kind of a little more morally gray, and I liked that the Crusader, you know, is kind of, you know, justice, kill demons, but also, like, you know, if someone gets hurt along the way, it's not that bad. And so my secondary character was a Lich King necromancer, which was also fun to explore as well. Because there's so much lore between, like, the Lich King and the Archmage that there's so much to explore. Even though, you know, my character is closely tied to the Lich King, they're also inevitably tied to the Archmage, whether they want to or not, because of that kind of lore behind it. So everything, it's, you know, it's a big circle. Everything is connected. And it's really interesting to see how all of those factors play out.
Cody, as the GM, like, do you have any, like, personal favorites? Like, if you were to get to play at the table, like, this is definitely the icon I would throw relationship points in.
As a GM, I really appreciate the flexibility that icons provide. I can push them positive or negative as a campaign needs. I do really like the Prince of Shadows as an enigmatic force in the background.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with the second half of this interview with Cody and the other members of the 13th Age official Pelgrane Twitch stream.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.